Welcome to The Explainer. This is a product of the East African Center for Investigative Reporting with support from the USAID. This month, we hear from two experts as we make sense of one problem. 2 years ago, Anita Mong, then Deputy House Speaker, announced that a poorly attended plenary meeting had greenlit the Mining and Minerals Bill 2021. President Museveni asserted to the amended legislation in October of 2022. This was nearly 2 decades since the law was first enacted. Innocence is nowhere to be seen in Uganda's extractive sector, possibly because it does not exist. A shroud of secrecy around the sector gives it a bad rap, deservedly so. The local governments in districts that team up with minerals have found themselves caught in the crosshairs. Mining royalties that could do them a world of good keep being lost to leakages that are variously defined. This month on The Explainer, we are asking, can Uganda's extractive sector get back what increasingly feels like a lost innocence?
Now, indeed, it is true that the extractive industry is very opaque. And because of its opaque nature, there are many illicit flows. There are many flows that flow that arise from it, both licit and illicit. Now, obviously, our focus here today is on the illicit component of it. Now, when it comes to extractives, yes, the Financial Intelligence Authority of Uganda, just like other financial intelligence units across the world, we're interested in this sector because it's one of the highest income generating sources for many of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa and other parts of the world, and also because the end product is one that is desired by many wealthy nations across the globe. So because of the amounts that are generated, that first of all, the size of the industry, and in Uganda's case in particular, because we are surrounded by countries that are resource rich, and even ourselves we're resource rich in terms of extractives. So yes, this is very critical and very central to our work at the Financial Intelligence Authority, especially insofar as identifying what the risks in terms of money laundering are concerned. Not so much to do with terrorism financing, but much more to do with the money laundering aspects of it. And we have done studies in that area.
Last year, Uganda's Financial Intelligence Agency, for the first time, assessed environmental and natural resources crimes. This was in the country's second assessment of money laundering and terrorism financing risks. The report covers the period of April 2017 to June 2021 for all sectors except terrorism financing, which covered the period ending December 2021. Last year, you were at the helm of the Financial Intelligence Authority when the second National Risk Assessment Report was released. Can you please give us a sense of what the major takeaways from the report are?
Yeah, first of all, a National Risk Assessment Report is a report that is intended to identify the key risks that a country faces insofar as money laundering, terrorism financing, and what we call proliferation financing are concerned. And the rationale for it is that resources are never finite. Therefore, there must be a mechanism of identifying what the risks are and apply resources to those areas that are deemed more high risk, and then apply less resources to those that are deemed a lower risk. Now, when an item is low risk, it doesn't mean you don't apply any resources there, but it means we apply less resources than those that are deemed high risk. And when we talk of resources here, we're talking about financial resources, capital resources, and any other kind of resource that can be leveraged to address that that risk. So yes, we carried out, this was the second national risk assessment for Uganda. The first one was done 4 years ago. This one was an update and struck a new one. So yes, so that was the reason why we had to do this national risk assessment. And Because when you're doing the risk assessment, you look at the internal threats as well as the external threats to the country. And also you look at the industries or the sectors that are most high risk, and then with a view or with the aim of putting in place mitigants.
The report assessed the vulnerability of the environmental and natural resources crimes on the basis of 18 intermediate variables. Mining stroke extraction was one of the environmental and natural resources crimes that the glare of the spotlight illuminated. Its money laundering ability was found to be desperately low. Conversely, its vulnerability to money laundering was found to be alarmingly high. What are some of the areas you're able to identify that carry a larger threshold in terms of risk?
Now, it's really a very varied thing, but one, we identified the crimes. First of all, the difference between the results of the first national risk assessment and the second one, there were minimal changes. The results were almost the same, meaning that within 4 years, nothing had changed. Now, we identified the five crimes that generate most money that is illicit in nature, that is then laundered. One is, of course, corruption in its various forms. Two, we had tax crimes or tax evasion. Then three, we had trafficking in wildlife products. And then four, we had trafficking in persons, and then counterfeit products. These were the main crimes that generated money that was then subsequently laundered. Mm-hmm. And then we also confirmed that most of the money that is laundered is invested in real estate, not only in Uganda, but this is a trend that is global across the world. And then we also identified the countries that posed the highest risk. And these are countries naturally, because these are two categories. One, countries that we do a lot of trade with. And then two, especially with trade, what we call trade-based money laundering. So countries like India, United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. And then we also had countries that are neighbors because of the porous nature of our borders. So all our neighboring countries were also deemed to be high risk to us, because many of the illicit products were from them. For example, the wildlife products, the illicit minerals, and the rest were from the Democratic Republic of Congo and the rest. And then we established that Uganda was largely a transit country. So many of these products were not staying in Uganda as a country, but Uganda was being used as a transit. So our task, having identified this, then the next question is, what do we do? What steps do we need to take as a country to ensure that we're not used as a transit country? Yes.
You assessed environmental and natural resource crimes for the first time. Is there any specific reason why elements of environmental and natural resource crimes were not previously considered for the first risk assessment report?
Yeah, now the tool we used, we used a tool developed by the World Bank. The World Bank has rights to this tool, and Uganda, through the Financial Intelligence Authority, acquired the rights to use this tool. Now, this is a self-assessment tool. The World Bank gives the country the tool, and then the country uses it. So it's not a World Bank done exercise, but they developed the tool. Now, the first tool did not have this module, because we have nine modules. At that time, there were nine modules. But obviously, there, because of changes, because of the new tool, because the first tool that was available did not have two categories of crimes, did not have tax crimes as a standalone module, and did not also have environmental crimes. So when the new tool was released in 2022, I believe, it had these two different aspects. So it was additional. So the simple reason is that the first module did not have, and now the second module had. And I'm happy to say that Uganda was one of the first countries to actually use these two new, to assess these two new modules. So when you read the older national risk assessments for Uganda and other countries, you will not find these two modules. But when you read ours and those that are subsequent, then you'll find these modules as well. So that's the explanation.
So mining stroke extraction were joined by fisheries as the major pain points in the ENI category. The ENR crimes, which are the environmental and natural resource crimes of both to money laundering, were deemed highly vulnerable. The money laundering combating ability of both was also rated low. If we may zoom into mining stroke extraction, how did you arrive at giving it those dire ratings?
The tool has cause, or what we call the vulnerabilities. Now, and then if there's a vulnerability, and then the question is there a remedy to cover that vulnerability? If the answer is no, then the score is very high. The risk is very high because so that is how we're doing the scores. Now, in this particular issue, the first question was, what is the volume? Is it material? And the answer was yes, because the question was that Uganda largely has what we call artisanal mining or surface mining. And yet we have records from the Central Bank and Uganda Revenue Authority showing that it's one of the leading generators of forex for the country. Now the question is, how is this possible? Because we do not have deep shaft mining. These figures do not seem to correspond.
Uganda's export receipts for gold have prompted a mixture of derision and alarm from observers. While the precious metal remains the country's top forex earner, its potential to open doors for rogue elements from the mining to retailing stages means that surface level observations are hardly helpful.
Given the fact that gold that is exported or that is re-exported, there are no levies on it. There are no royalties paid. So if, for example, gold is just passing through, if it's from Congo, Zimbabwe or Tanzania or any other country, and it is transiting through Entebbe, the importer and then re-exporter does not pay any royalties. Now, so the fact that royalties are being paid or taxes are being collected would lead to the conclusion that this is actually gold mined here. So the question is, where is it mining? Where is it coming from? Is it from the known and the areas we know? Is it from Mubende? Is it from Karamoja? Is it from Busia? The answer is no. Now, so that is the opaqueness. And then two, we have porous borders. Now, because we have porous borders, which are motorable, meaning they're easily passable, that was another risk factor. Do we have safeguards? The answer is no, because we have a large stretch of border that is motorable and that we don't have controls, because URA, our tax body, is only at gazetted points. But this gold is smuggled through other motorable channels. So that was another risk factor. And then three, the issue is in our context here in the region, in addition to the corruption and the avoidance of tax, we also have the blood diamonds or the war diamonds. There are prohibitions about export mining conflict minerals from the DRC. So how do you distinguish? How do you ensure that this does not come into our supply chain? And again, there were weaknesses in this area, because there were very few safeguards, if any, to stop. How do you distinguish when it has entered into the market? So because there were very few checks, that's why it was rated very, very, very high.
But there are cases of connivance by the tax collection officials at these border points with those who are engaging in the smuggling of some of these minerals into the country?
No, there's no connivance. Actually, that is the issue. The gold that comes through the formal channels, entering into the country and then leaving the country, mostly through Entebbe, is properly taxed. But the challenge is that a lot of it comes into the country illegally. And because it is illicit and because it's illegal, we cannot tell the volume, because the smugglers deliberately avoid the tax authority. So that is why it is a smuggling crime. Now, steps have been, attempts have been made to curb this, but in my view, they have not been successful or they have not been robust enough because we still have these figures. So I think the question should be, the ones that, because we have refineries here, for example. Now, many of the refineries do assaying and then then they export the finished product, not the raw. Now, we do not have mechanisms in place other than the Kimberley processes and the rest. We do not have actual processes on ground to ensure that what is actually declared is what is exported. The source is not well defined, because if the and then the suppliers, who are the suppliers? I know that many because of the, there is no law at present that requires the refiners to make public their suppliers. They have confidentialities and things like that. So, and the reason why, and the companies have been resisting, saying that because it's a very dangerous trade, there's a lot of rivalries, there's a lot of funny things. So they want to protect the identity of their suppliers. As a result, law enforcement agencies have been encountering difficulties accessing the supplier list to these refineries. And now the other problem is, and this is where the hypocrisy of those that import, taking these minerals, especially gold and diamond, comes in. Because a lot of the gold or these minerals go to Dubai, to the United Arab Emirates. And then from there,
up in Belgium as well.
Yes, then, yes, Belgium as well. Then they go to the third, other countries. Now, UAE in most countries, in most cases, is defined as the country of origin. But we know that UAE does not have these mines.
That's true.
So the country of origin ought to be the country where these minerals originally came from. But these other companies that deem UAE to be the source do not want to ask the uncomfortable questions. So that is where the hypocrisy comes. Because if you say UAE, say, where are the mines? Show us the mines, show us where you are getting these things from. So if you are importing them from another country, then what steps do you have in place to ensure that that country has complied with the required global standards?
Let's then peel off another layer that engenders corruption. With me is the Energy and Extractive Industries Coordinator at Oxfam Uganda, Raj Magara. The extractive sector in Uganda remains shrouded in opaqueness, and there are fears that leakages could be resulting into colossal losses of revenue to the country, which we need, of course, because Uganda is collecting its tax to GDP ratio is very low compared to other countries in the region, including Kenya. In your view, how is this contributing to illicit financial flows?
I'm also thinking the way you introduced that Uganda's extractive resources have enormous potential. Aside oil and gas, which is yet to be produced, we have a very rich mineral potential, which we can actually harness and be able to mastermind the development of our country. However, you find that if you look at the EITI report of this year, mining only contributed to GDP by a rate of 1.43%. And that tells you that we are getting a paltry, very small percentage contribution from the mining sector.
An aura of total opacity continues to cloud Uganda's extractive industry. The Uganda Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative report for the fiscal year 2021 to 2022 indicates that only 1.3 billion shillings was remitted to local governments out of 6.49 billion shillings. The scorecards of the past two reporting periods were just as grim. Just over 2 billion shillings out of 7 billion shillings was remitted in mining royalties in the first reporting year, and 1.47 billion shillings out of 7.36 billion shillings in the second. This is simply not good enough.
If you compare with other countries like Tanzania, whose mining to GDP is close to 10%, and yet we know that the geological formation of Uganda, Tanzania, and maybe other East African states is pretty much similar. And therefore, our potential should also be not at 1.43% to GDP. It should be 5 or something above. And what that means is that there are things we have not done right, including leakages that you are talking about. In the first place, the sector is a bit still disorganized, the mining sector, managed by largely the informal sector, the artisanal and small-scale mining. And also being not well monitored to generate the much needed revenue from the sector. So a combination of that and many other factors have undermined our potential to generate enough revenue.
The Uganda Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative's third report raises a number of red flags about the going-ons in Uganda's extractive sector. This cannot be wished away.
When you look at how we are able to make returns of the revenues from different mineral ores that are produced in the country, you find that URIA is not having a very good record of how much we are generating in terms of the production volumes. I want to give an example of, for example, marble, for example, from Karamoja. You find that every day there are trucks of marble being transported, others being utilized in Tororo because we also have a factory there. But determining the volume, how much tons do we produce in a day, that's something that URIA is not confident about, because in the first place, we don't have like a web bridge to determine the tons of marble that come from Karamoja maybe to go to Tororo, those that are under Tororo cement. And consequently, you find that the returns that companies file with URIA, whether they are compromised or not, URIA takes them as gospel truth. So that automatically undermines the much needed revenue from these minerals. And ultimately, that translates also into the royalties, because when you determine a royalty is also valued at production, you value the amount of royalty depending on how much you have produced. So if there is erroneous reporting of the production volume, maybe deliberately under-reporting, it means that the royalties also will be under-reported. And that's why you find that many districts that receive royalties, they receive very, very little money because of the declarations, of the under-declarations of most of the mining companies. That's one. The second aspect is the informality. If you look at most artisanal who are not registered, who are not known, their production is not recorded, and therefore many artisanal and small-scale miners don't pay taxes, and they don't even make a declaration very consistent with the records. And if there is that kind of informality, it can also instigate even smuggling. Because if someone picks gold maybe from Amudat and there is no proper record of it, who can stop that person from crossing Kenya and taking it there? Because we don't have that kind of strict monitoring to ensure that we are able to determine how much is produced and where does it go. And we have been very weak at the issue of traceability. We are not able to trace. The mechanism for tracing the minerals has not been fully operationalized. I know it is still work in progress.
There are not easy solutions or fixes to the problems assailing Uganda's extractive sector. Problems around data accuracy, quality, and institutional accountability require responses that are both prodigious and intensely imaginative.
So all of those factors have really undermined our potential to generate enough revenue, and in one way or another may lead to illicitness, as you mentioned, because we shall see minerals crossing borders, we shall see minerals coming in, when actually we are not in the full control of determining where they are sourced from. So it is important that the Minister of Energy and Mineral Development, plus other stakeholders, concretize plans of how we can reduce the informality of the sector in the first place by registering the artisan and small scale miners, but doesn't stop at registering them. It also encompasses many more programs of empowering them financially, because the reasons why they are informal is because they don't have enough capital to formalize their operations, to get better technology, to use capital intensive methods of production. So they resort to many labor intensive methods. So if they can be mobilized, they can be empowered, they are given proper support in terms of financial inclusion. They are able to get cheap financing that can help them access improved technology, which technology can help them get the minerals at a cheaper cost. At the same time, helps them to stop using environmentally hazardous methods of mining. Like, you are aware that in gold mining, some people use mercury, and therefore mercury is very deadly to their health and environment.
The folks who seem to be controlling the mining sector are very powerful individuals. That the tax collector sometimes is reluctant to enforce their rights, because we've also seen, for instance, in Karamoja, we've seen the involvement of the army and so on and so forth. How can we ensure that the tax collector is able to play his role or their role to ensure that, for instance, we know what is coming out of the ground so that people are able to pay the exact royalties? Because without that, then we can't be able to achieve the much-vaunted growth, as we like we see in Tanzania, where mining contributes to about 10% of their GDP.
Yeah, I think largely we need to appreciate that the issue of streamlining revenue collections can be really a work in progress. And we have formulated and launched the new Mining Act 2022. And I believe that it is where we could have put all the safety nets to safeguard the sector. And I know there were some good provisions that really support this. And this has been further supported by regulations. The mining regulations that have been finalized after the mining law. But also to think that the EITI, the opaqueness comes in, yes, but EITI has fairly supported information flow. Now, the information which was officially not available, now with the EITI, we are able to see the information. We're able to know how much is being reported and how much is available in terms of production volumes. And that's why we are able to tell that this is not the right potential.
Which brings me to the next question, that for the fiscal year 2021-2022, about 500 companies have been red flagged for paying less royalties or not paying any funds to the local government. This, the Inspectorate of Government findings also indicate that about 800 million shillings is lost annually in royalty fees. But you say that even this may be paltry. Is that the case, Mr. Siraj?
Yes, because there has not been a very serious follow-up on the part of Ministry of Energy and URIA on making sure that they track the production volume. So it's true that the royalty that is reported is underreported, because there is not a very good mechanism to track the production volumes. I guess in a point, if gold is produced in any of these spots where there is gold mining, how do we determine that so much has come out of this? So it must be having a mechanism with good officers who are on the ground and be able to register every small amount of gold that is produced, and then keep adding and know that in this mine site, so much is produced on a daily basis. And I think that work has not been done. So that's why I say that it is still work in progress to make sure that we support a robust system that can actually be there to monitor and track the production volumes. And these companies must report in relation to what these officers have monitored and found on the ground. But where we find no monitoring at all, and the company is reporting whatever they are reporting, then they are right to do under declaration. And maybe to mention that we still have policy issues. And one of them is over-centralization of the Minister of Energy. The sector itself, the Minister of Energy, is highly centralized. You don't have mining officers at the districts. So we don't have someone responsible to Ministry of Energy. Whereas we have an environmental officer who works directly with the Minister of Environment. We have the gender officer who works directly with the Minister of Gender. We don't have someone directly working with the Minister of Energy. And that means that the regulation is just in the cloud, it's up and down. The local governments do not participate. And that, since they are closer to the ground, they could be monitoring better than the central government, than the Minister of Energy.
If the mining sector is less transparent and opaque, it invites itself to being captured by those who want to engage in illicit financial flows. I guess you are aware of the Dow Mabo incident in Karamoja, where a fake investor came in, he duped people, he got money and vanished. Why is it important to ensure that the sector is opened up and is more transparent if we are to guard against the threat of illicit financial flows, in your view?
I think it should be in the interest of the government, because when revenue is generated and government gets it, it supports its agenda and be able to improve service delivery. So it is really the interest of government to have the sector working very well. And that's why it is important to make sure that all these avenues that were a springboard for illicitness, that were actually creating all these kind of leakages, should be fixed sooner than later.
Now, we return to our question. Can Uganda's extractive sector get back what increasingly feels like a lost innocence? Any optimism must be tempered by recognition of potential pitfalls ahead. Our first expert says this is especially so if the country continues to cast its lot with inaction.
I think Uganda has taken credible steps insofar as curbing the illicit flows in this regard, in this is concerned. But illicit flows are twofold. It is what you call the outflows and the inflows. Now, there appears to be a suggestion that Uganda is a beneficiary of illicit inflows, that Uganda is benefiting more from the inflows are coming into the country, so that Uganda is not a net, is actually is not a net loser when it comes to this regard. Now, that's not to say that's a good thing, that because illegal minerals are coming into the country and therefore we should be happy about it. So the question therefore means that to address this, those that the countries, especially in the neighborhood, from which these, because these are outflows from those countries, and then in our case, they are inflows. That means they have to do more, of course, working hand in hand with us.
I know that EITI is a very good tool that has helped us to, first of all, know where the problem is. Right now, with the reports that have been produced, 3 reports so far, we are able to tell where the weakness is. We are able to tell that the weakness is with the Ministry of Energy, the Ministry URA, and I think now for me the biggest weakness is on Ministry of Finance. We know that Ministry of Finance is in charge of mobilizing resources, mobilizing money, not so. And therefore, if you leave the sector to be masterminded by the Ministry of Energy, where we have geologists, engineers, whose expertise is not in that line of generating revenue for the country, then we have to miss it out. So I would implore the Minister of Finance to come in handy to support the Ministry of Energy, to support URA, to see how some of these leakages can be actually reduced.
Sensitizing all stakeholders, particularly local governments, about the amended Mining and Minerals Act will undoubtedly increase the odds of success. Once again, this explainer is a product of the East African Center for Investigative Reporting, and I've been your host, Emmanuel Mutaiziwa.